With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
If you weren't able to make it to our Who and You event Friday in Auckland, maybe the next best thing, as Alastair Harding reports in from that event. Hey, Alastair.
Thank you very much, Paul. Okay, so last Friday night in Auckland, in an incredible effort by the RCR team to pull it all together in just 1 week, Reality Check Radio hosted an event titled The Who and You, exploring agendas, treaties, sovereignty, and more. It was a panel discussion pulled together by RCR's very own Katie Ashby-Coppins, the lawyer who's been spearheading many of RCR's legal discussions on Legal Hub. And she brought with her two very big names. The first was Professor Ramesh Thakur, who's a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, and Dr. David Bell, who is a former World Health Organization medical officer and scientist. Both have been on RCR previously with Paul Brennan and also Marie Buskey, and both have impeccable credentials and are leaders in their fields. And together with Katie, what they brought with them was an insight into the World Health Organization's new international health regulations discussions that are blindingly absent from our media at the moment. The truth is, the World Health Organization's new regulations and their pandemic preparedness treaty are due to be voted on during the World Health Organization's World Health Assembly, set for May 27 to June 1 in Geneva in Switzerland. And there's a great fear that these legally binding treaties are going to strip away national sovereignty and destroy freedom of speech, among many other issues of concern. Of course, the people driving the treaty deny these charges. They say that these concerns are nothing more than conspiracy theories, but there's no way of actually knowing for sure, because our media simply refuses to ask the questions, or report, or discuss. And the World Health Organization themselves have been dragging their feet on releasing the final texts of the treaties. So there just isn't any way of knowing, except then by looking at previous drafts of the documents, which do suggest there is at least a discussion to be had. So, when there was a chance to actually discuss the treaty and its issues with people who do have credibility in the subject, RCR jumped at the opportunity to help inform New Zealanders who are concerned. And we were there recording the whole event. And there's going to be a video of the full event available soon for everyone who couldn't be there. But while that's being edited by our team, I'm here today, Alastair Harding, to play you some highlights and give you some clips of what was said. This was a world-class sold-out event on New Zealand soil hosted by Reality Check Radio. And it was started off by host and RCR co-founder Alia Bland, who explained what the evening was all about.
Okay, so it's really important for us to outline our reasoning for putting on this event tonight. As a result of the discussion you'll hear here tonight, we hope to arm you with a good understanding of the issues presented by the WHO's pandemic treaties, the amendments to the international health regulations, and the threats that they pose to our national and individual sovereignty. The second reason is we all know that people power creates change. The more we can spark interest on this topic, the more the word will spread, the more successful we'll be in orchestrating public and political pressure, and ultimately driving the action and change that we seek.
And so with that introduction by RCR co-founder Alia Bland done, it was up to Katie Ashby-Coppins to tell us what the treaties are all about, what New Zealand's involvement is, and how the World Health Organization has actually contributed to the confusion around this topic.
So, as mentioned, there are two treaty documents that are due to be voted on at the end of May. The 194 member states of the World Health Organization will attend in Geneva to vote on these two pandemic treaty reforms. Attending from New Zealand will probably be a Minister of Health, maybe, or certainly a public servant that will have the permission, I guess, to vote on these one way or the other. The interesting thing is that we've also got our former Director General of Health. Ashley Bloomfield, who has been negotiating these, particularly the International Health Regulation amendments, as co-chair of the working group. So he will no doubt be there as well. It's going to impact all of us. All of these documents will have a direct consequence on us when decisions are made by the Director General of the WHO. If you think the last 4 years was tough, the last 4 years looks pretty tame to what's going to be proposed in these documents. The WHO has broken its own rules in a couple of ways too, because it was actually required to deliver the amendments to the International Health Regulations in January of this year in accordance with one of its own articles. And it failed to do that. They came up with a legal opinion which was dodgy, and it suggested that, well, you've delivered these back in December 2022 originally, so that's the version that you can say that you delivered. But of course, they'd spent another 2 and a bit years crafting those and reworking them, and we've just seen the latest version, I think was 17th of April 2024, and, you know, likewise, the pandemic agreement was due to be delivered, final version, end of March 2024, so that all countries had the opportunity to consider the amendments, the impact on them, before voting. And that's not been allowed to happen. In fact, the versions that we've received in April are still a draft because they've continued to work on them for the last couple of weeks. So it's an atrocious situation for the World Health Organization to be really forcing countries into having to make a decision without having had time to properly consider these documents.
Thanks, Katie. I think back to the time when we were encouraging people to put in their feedback on that, and they were giving feedback on outdated amendments that had been overridden, but they wouldn't give us.
Yeah, and that was really crazy because, you know, you write to the government, you're like, this is an exercise in futility, writing submissions on documents that you know are out of date, and you've probably seen a later version, you know. But you know what? We got over 3,000 submissions in for the International Health Regulations. The pandemic treaty is still open, and you know that was a very marked difference from the time when they first allowed opportunity for feedback, when I think there were 16 submissions that were submitted back in August last year. So it is a sign that people are talking about these things and the awareness is increasing, because it's so important.
And so then, as the microphone was passed between the panellists, our host for the evening, Alia Bland, asked Dr. David Bell and Professor Ramesh Thakur what they'd like our leaders to know before they go signing the World Health Organization treaties. And it's probably important to remember, the first voice you're going to hear with the Australian twang is Dr. David Bell, who's not only worked in the World Health Organization, but has also worked with the likes of Bill Gates personally. And the second voice with the Indian accent belongs to Professor Ramesh Thakur, who worked as the Assistant Secretary General at the UN under Kofi Annan. What I'm trying to point out is that these are men with great insight and knowledge of how these things work. So first, Dr. David Bell's response.
So it's this issue of pandemic risk that they need to understand. They're dealing with a really small problem. We've seen an increase in reported pandemics since the 1960s because we invented ways, you know, to detect them. We couldn't detect Nipah virus before the late 1990s. It doesn't mean Nipah virus suddenly appeared. It's an example. It's in bats throughout Asia and Africa. But it causes an encephalitis, very small outbreaks. They disappear. There's never been an outbreak of more than 110 people dead. So there's always been small outbreaks, and they go away again, and we didn't know what they were, so we'd attribute them to this or that, or we'd never hear about them because we didn't have digital communications. We didn't even have roads in a lot of places. We've developed all this. Now we can detect a lot of outbreaks, and we detect a lot of viral variants, which are potential cause of outbreaks. And this is a large part of the funding for these agreements is going to detect these variants. That doesn't mean it is an outbreak. It means it's a viral variant, which viruses change in nature. What we're doing is trying to detect nature, and we're getting better and better at detecting nature. What we're then doing is turning that into a pretense that this is a dramatic increase, and we read in WHO and World Bank documents and so on about an existential threat to humanity or a rapid increase in emergence of new diseases. What we've done is develop the ability to detect diseases. What we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years in the large, like the Gideon database, which is the largest database of outbreaks, is what the World Bank uses in their reports, etc. We see a reduction in the number of outbreaks, a reduction in the mortality from outbreaks. And there's a very good reason for this, because we've got better at detecting them, but we're also getting better at managing health in general, and we're generally getting better nutrition, etc. So the risk that we're dealing with is going away, or is getting smaller. The pandemics were a huge problem 100, 200, 300 years ago. Most of those were bacterial. We don't see them anymore. We don't see big outbreaks at play because we have antibiotics. Cholera, we know it's due to bad sanitation. We fix that. So we have much bigger issues in health. But what we will do by diverting these resources, and we're talking about $30 to $40 billion a year in funding, which is 10 times what we give to the WHO now. It's an enormous amount of money. What we'll be doing is taking money from the programs that actually matter, that actually help health, and putting them into this essentially a niche area. I think that the last thing I'd just say and that they need to understand is why we live longer now than we used to. And it is, well, we discussed it, we mentioned it, it's because of better nutrition, it's because of antibiotics, to some extent sanitation to a large part, better living conditions. And none of this is in any of these documents. None of it is in any of the funding that's suggested. But what we will see is a reduction in funding for these areas that we know actually matter because of the diversion to this niche area, which really the only major outcome is going to be a concentration of wealth and profits for the pharmaceutical industry and very little else.
The same question to you, Professor Thicker. If you had a magic wand to give our decision makers an instant understanding of the threats before us, what would be the most important aspects to have them know?
Understand that the WHO is first and foremost an international bureaucracy, not a collection of the world's leading scientists and medical scientists. As a bureaucracy, they have their own interests. In the public health area in particular, as in so many other areas, the interests of the high-income industrialized countries often diverge from that of the low-income poor countries. In our part of the world, the average age of COVID-related mortality has been at or higher than average life expectancy. So 4 years later, if you take people at that age, most of them have a life expectancy of 6 to 12 months anyway, and especially if they're in care homes, as a lot of these were, many would have died in any case. But diverting resources away from other priority areas for younger populations and from their educational requirements and from the need to avoid rapid inflation, which burdens them with the debt decades into the future, all those has meant that a few extra months for people my age was stolen from many life years that would have applied to the younger people. That's a crazy world in terms of priorities. That's in our world. In developing countries, on the other hand, as I said, we need to keep improving sanitation, nutrition, childhood immunization. All of these were badly disrupted from supply chain disruptions, from people being locked up at home instead of being allowed to go to school, and screenings and detection were lost. As I said, the food insecurity. So a lot of problems occurred there. The outcomes were bad. We do need to go and look at that. And the failures of the WHO, the extent to which it got captured by different donor interests and private sector in the name of philanthropic foundations or whatever, in fact, actually pursuing their own thing. You should go and look up reputable sources for the increase in net assets of one Mr. Bill Gates from 2019 to 2022. It's several billion, his total assets. So philanthropy can be very profitable. These are important issues, and most importantly, I think political leaders need to accept that it's their responsibility to manage all of public policy, to manage the whole breadth of public health and health. That simply saying I was following the science is no excuse to abdicate on their solemn responsibility and hand over power and decision-making control to the public health bureaucrats.
Now, unfortunately, the event did go on for a couple of hours, and we did also have a Q&A at the end when the audience got a chance to ask questions. So we can't play everything that was talked about in this report. But as I said at the top, we did record the event with a number of cameras, so it's being edited as I speak, and that will be available for all of you to see and listen to very soon. So this has been a little taste of what went on for our non-Auckland audience who couldn't be there. And I want to leave you with the final thoughts of Professor Thakur on the role of the media in all of this, because the reason this event was necessary was that the media didn't show any interest at all. But it is, of course, of great interest to the people of New Zealand, and the fact that it was a sold-out event is testimony to that. There was a press conference in the afternoon before the event. The media were invited but didn't show up. Which is astonishing, really, because we've got a subject here that affects our nation's sovereignty and it has global ramifications. And we had international experts here who really are experts in the topics discussed, who have worked at the very heights of the organisations that are driving these discussions. And that's valuable insight for anyone who's interested in this topic, whichever side of the debate you're on. So to wrap up, here's Professor Ramesh Thakur, former UN Assistant Secretary General, telling us what he thinks has happened to the media and why they aren't interested in a global story like this one.
The media lost its inquisitiveness and curiosity. It's lost its ability to do its job. It's a combination of cutbacks and training and change of ethos and becoming increasingly dependent on government direct largesse or advertising revenue and fearing control. Is the growth of the censorship industrial complex as well, where broadcast regulators have become overly and overtly politicized rather than ensuring standards of impartiality across the board. COVID became immensely profitable to governments in the expansion and abuse of state power, but it was also immensely profitable to legacy media in terms of clickbaits and eyeballs. But the long-term damage to the profession is now being mapped in poll after poll in so many countries with respect to the falling trust, the falling viewership and readership. And, you know, it used to be the case that I won't believe this until it has been officially denied in the pages of the New York Times. Well, now, who do you trust? And that's a very high price to pay long term for the media. And the growth of institutions like Reality Check Radio, like alternative media, why have they attracted such a big following? There never would have been a niche market for them if the mainstream media had done its job properly.
That's right.
And interrogated governments instead of acting as propaganda pieces for ministerial handouts.
And so there you have it. Professor Ramesh Thakur, former Assistant Secretary General for the UN, telling us what he thinks has gone wrong with the media and all of this, alongside Dr. David Bell and RCR's own legal brain, Katie Ashby-Coppins, and host of the event, RCR co-founder Alia Bland, on stage at the Who and You event held last Friday night in Central Auckland, hosted by Reality Check Radio. And as I said at the top, we've filmed the entire event, so that will be available for you to view very shortly. But in the meantime, this has just been a quick highlight reel for those who weren't able to get there. My name's Alistair Harding, and you're listening to Reality Check Radio.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.